Hello and welcome to In the Booth on your official home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650. I'm Brandon Batchelor, as always, joined by Randy Janda. And In the Booth is brought to you by Bells and Whistles.
That's right. Catch all the action, hockey, football, soccer, and more with Happy Hour Pints for $6.75. Bells and Whistles, 3296 Fraser Street, just off Kingsway, right in the Fraser Hood.
As the Canucks are coming off an impressive 3-0 win over the Maple Leafs on Saturday at Scotiabank Arena in Toronto. A lot of things were going against Vancouver in that game. They had the travel issues. They were playing on the second half of a back-to-back after losing to the Hurricanes on Friday, third game in four nights. Banged up roster to a certain extent. Quinn Hughes playing at less than 100%. Elias Pettersson only just back into the lineup, still missing Philip Hronek and Dakota Joshua. And yet the Canucks come out and play one of their most complete games of the year against a Maple Leafs team that, other than, you know, like an 8-minute stretch, I would say, in the second half of the first period, didn't really put up that much of a fight. And I know that's a concern in Leafs land, but we're a Canucks podcast. We call the Canuck games here on Sportsnet 650. So we're going to focus on that side of things, a gritty and good road win for this Vancouver team in the center of the universe.
Yeah, there was energy. There was timely scoring. I thought a lot of their plays were simple, and I mean that in a good way, but the word that comes to mind, Batch, is committed. They were defensively committed. They were winning puck battles. They won nearly 67% of the puck battles on the night, dominating the Leafs in that perspective, and defending consistently strong. And even though the offense at times maybe doesn't look as sharp as it should, and you know, if we're measuring the chances and do they look lethal, if you're defending that way, you're giving yourself a chance in all the games that you play. And I think with Toronto, that game, Vancouver looked kind of like Carolina the night before, controlled the game, managed it, and held the Leafs to 20 shots. So you look at that, and I say for Vancouver, that was just a gritty effort to your point, but a committed effort.
Yeah, it certainly was. And let's talk about some individual performances in the game that impressed us. And we have to start, I think, with Elias Pettersson, who played arguably his best game of the season thus far. And it's not like he was an offensive dynamo that carried the Canucks to the win in that regard, but it was his 200-foot game, his willingness to block shots and get in shooting lanes and commit to that side of the game that I think, rightfully so, got him a lot of plaudits, not just from the fan base and the media, but from his head coach after the game as well.
Yeah, specifically 5 block shots, but he engaged defensively, as I mentioned, block shots, but breaking up plays as well. And there's a lot of discussion, apparently on the bench, they're talking about, you know, the Selke, yelling Selke. Kiefer Sherwood talked a little bit about that as well. This is an individual that I know he's just back from his injury. The Carolina game, I thought he played okay, you know, considering he was coming back from injury. But that game against Toronto matched up against the top line from the other side. And that was a very, very, I don't want to say elite because it's one game, but that individually, that game, you know, 200 foot wise, as far as defensively, that was an elite defensive game. And, you know, how are you able to make a difference if you're a star player on the Vancouver Canucks, one of their top two centers? Of course, we're looking at offense, but can you impact the game by shutting down the opposition? And Elias Pettersson was able to do exactly that. A very, I think, confidence-inducing victory and game from him, where he's going to be coming out of that game saying, hey, you know what? The offense will come. I got 1 point, but if I can play defense like that, if I can limit the opposition like that, that's almost like a point or an assist or a goal, because he's making a huge impact on the defensive side of things.
Yeah, and hopefully, you know, with the time out of the lineup, he's back to being fully healthy. And now that we're into the second half of the season, can build off of that, can create some momentum, and can get back to being the kind of player that Canucks fans know he is capable of being. We also have to talk about Kevin Lankinen and his 4th shutout of the season. Not that he was tested too much, but had to make a couple of pretty good saves and continues to be a difference maker for this Vancouver team to the point now where, and you know, not to take anything away from Thatcher Demko because he's still only just getting back, had to miss a handful of games with back spasms. But I think as you look ahead to the game against Winnipeg on Tuesday, I'd be going back to Lankinen based on how well he's playing and the confidence that he's instilling in his teammates right now.
For sure he is. And I think, you know, the way I looked at this, even when Demko got back from injury the first time around, was it's a 1A, 1B until Thatcher Demko shows you that he's up to speed, he's ready to go. But now you start looking at Lankinen's game, and so I think it's also a 1A, 1B situation until Lankinen drops off a little bit. This guy has four shutouts. He's two behind Connor Hellebuck now, because Connor Hellebuck had another one on Saturday night. So he's showing you that he can play at a very high level. So I think with Lankinen, not only is he showing Vancouver what he can do, if you're Team Finland in the Four Nations faceoff, of course UC Saros is the guy there. But guess what, Batch? Four shutouts for Saros, four for Lankinen. To me, it's a little bit more of a conversation. I think Finland will go with Saros in the end, but you know, he's actually making a little bit of a case here to say, not only am I the number one on Vancouver right now, maybe I should be for Finland as well.
Yeah, and it's such a great story after how late he signed and the contract that he ended up inking with the Canucks. And I know we've got a question about Lankinen that we'll get to in the mailbag after the break, so we'll talk more about his contract situation coming up in a few minutes on the show. But wouldn't that be a cool story if he ends up getting games or playing in the crease for Finland at the Four Nations faceoff after not having an NHL contract at the start of September? Another player we have to talk about, and we do this all the time so it gets repetitive, but Quinn Hughes had a banner Quinn Hughes performance, and I think it was important that he did in Toronto on a Saturday night on hockey night in Canada with the hockey world watching, because I don't think there's enough of an appreciation in league-wide circles and especially out east about how much Quinn Hughes means to the Canucks and how much he can impact the game. Well, he showed exactly how big a factor he can be against Toronto on Saturday night.
2 points plus three, and actually, you know, just everywhere from a defensive perspective, we saw him, you know, skating up a storm like he usually does. The possession time numbers are through the roof, but you know, in a game like that, Batch, I think him showing what he can do is one thing, but also having his numbers or time on ice less than 25 minutes for once. He's not playing 26, 27 minutes. You build a lead and you're able to allow him a couple of minutes rest. That's big. So he makes his impact. He's able to generate points, but at the same time, you can give him, even if it's 2 minutes, a bit of a break. This guy's been eating so many minutes. He's been so important for this team. You have a 3-goal lead and you can sit back a little bit and say, hey, Captain, sit down. We're going to give some of these other guys an opportunity to lean in here. So I thought that was a best case scenario where he was able to showcase what he could do and he could also take a bit of a breather.
So it was a great win for the Canucks over the Maple Leafs on Saturday. They'll wrap up the road trip on Tuesday against the Winnipeg Jets. We'll look ahead to that game and we'll get into the mailbag when we return on In the Booth on your official home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to In the Booth on Sportsnet 650, your official home of the Canucks. Brendan Batchelor and Randy Janda with you. And a reminder, this show lives as a podcast. Make sure you subscribe to the Canucks Central podcast feed. You get the daily show with Sat and Reach. You get every Canucks postgame show with Sat and Bic. And you get this show, In the Booth, weekly as well. And Randeep, In the Booth is brought to you by Bells and Whistles.
That's right, Batch. Catch all the action, hockey, football, soccer, and more with Happy Hour Pints for $6.75, 3296 Fraser Street, just off Kingsway, right in the Fraser Hood. And I was there after hockey night, Punjabi, this past Saturday night. So I got to say, maybe, you know, if you swing by after a Saturday night broadcast, you might see me there occasionally.
burning the midnight oil at Bells and Whistles. Randy,
gotta decompress, right? You got to decompress a little bit. Perfect spot to do so.
Absolutely. All right, let's get into the mailbag here. As always, we got lots of questions from you, the listener, coming off the Canucks' impressive 3-0 victory in Toronto over the Maple Leafs. And we'll start with Princess Erica 84 on Twitter, who writes in and asks, was Saturday's win against the Leafs the best game the Canucks have played this season? And I don't think so. I look back to that home ice win against the Panthers and say that that was a really comprehensive performance for this Canucks group. So that's where my vote would go. But the Leafs game certainly in the top five, maybe even higher than that, based on the overall performance from the drop of the puck to the final horn.
Yeah, I think there's three games that come to mind for me this season that you could say the Canucks were most in control. And one of those would be the Florida game you mentioned. The other one would probably be the Toronto game that we most recently saw and covered. And then the other game I would probably throw in that mix is what the Canucks 4-2 win over the Kings in November. That was a road game. I thought that was one of their stronger games as well to end off that road trip. But for Vancouver, that Toronto game, it was solid. That was rock solid. That's how you want to rebound off a bad loss to Carolina. And that was something, you know, when we talk about game management, Batch, I thought they haven't blown out teams this season, but that was a in-control game.
Yeah, I'd also vote for the 3-1 win over the Avalanche back in mid-December as well. Yeah. I put that on the list. So, you know, those I think are all in the same conversation. The interesting thing coming out of this Leafs game is going to be, okay, you know, we're talking about a handful of really good wins for this team. And I know they've faced a lot of adversity through the first half. They start off the second half with that win. Can that be the start of something? Or is it going to be a game we look back on later in the year as one of a handful where this team played up to its potential? That to me is the interesting conversation coming out of that game. Is not, you know, was that the best game of the year? Although I think it's in the conversation, but can that be the start of something? Can that be the beginning of this team finding its game and playing with more consistency rather than some of those other performances we talked about where, yeah, they played really well against the Kings, but then had some inconsistent play afterwards. Yeah, they had a couple of good wins within a week against the Panthers and the Avalanche, but in the middle of those two wins was a 5-1 loss to the Bruins. So I'll be interested to see if that game against the Leafs is the start of something for this Canucks team.
For sure, and what makes this a little different compared to maybe earlier on in the schedule was that you've got no softballs coming up in the next three games. So when you talk about following up a very good effort on the road, you've got the Jets, you've got the Kings, you've got the Oilers. We're talking about three of the better teams in the Western Conference. And even after that, you got Buffalo coming into town. We've seen Buffalo beat Vancouver, right? So it's not like that's an easy out either. This is a team that has shown that they can beat Vancouver. But yeah, I think consistency. And the team, you know, post-game against Toronto, Kiefer Sherwood was saying all the right things of, hey, this is a much-needed win, and you want to build off of this. But you got to win puck battles like you won against Toronto. You got to limit the middle of the ice defensively like you did against Toronto in the upcoming games. And, Batch, I got to tell you, that Jets game is not going to be easy, right? The way that the Winnipeg Jets have been playing this year, even though maybe they haven't been as, you know, red hot as they started the season, and it's tough to do that since they were historically good. You know, this is a team that's going to challenge Vancouver, but this is kind of what Vancouver has to do now. String along solid, very good efforts back to back to back.
Our next question comes from Austin in Langley, who writes in and asks, is it time to extend Lankinen? Feel like his agent is doing cartwheels. And it was another strong performance for Kevin Lankinen in Toronto on Saturday night, picking up the shutout, his fourth of the season now, and he continues to play well for this team. He continues to play well for them on the road in particular. The thing I'll say, though, is I don't think it actually behooves Kevin Lankinen to sign with the Canucks right now, because there's still half a season left. He's got plenty of opportunity to continue playing well, continue to see his stock rise. And especially because there's uncertainty around Thatcher Demko, I don't know if the organization wants to commit 100% to Kevin Lankinen just yet either, although that may be a reality. And we've heard them say that, look, we might have to spend more on goaltending than we would otherwise because of the situation with Demko, and maybe that means Lankinen does stay in Vancouver, but I can't dispute the fact that he's a big part of the reason the Canucks are still sitting in a playoff spot at this point in the year.
Absolutely, he is, and I think we're in all agreement that Quinn Hughes has been the MVP for this team, but yeah, if you had to look at a runner-up right now, Kevin Lankinen is right up there, and extension-wise, hey, if you're the Vancouver Canucks, absolutely you want that deal. You want to lock this guy in. What that dollar figure is, I'm not sure, but if you are the camp of the player, and you mentioned it, if you're Todd Diamond and Mark Gandler, who are his agents, you're saying, wait a second, let this play out a little bit. If he gets a little bit more, you know, games played, which his career high is 37, Batch, he's already at 29 this season. If you are the agents, you're saying, no, let's set some career highs. Let's continue to keep this ball rolling so that number is going to be up there, you know, with the Joey DeCords of the world, right? There is a market set for players that have maybe feature similar to a Kevin Lankinen. So if that floor now is, you know, a number that we're looking at $5 million, you know, as a Canucks fan, you probably want to lock this guy up ASAP. But if you're an older player like Kevin Lankinen, who's been around a little bit, he's been a bit of a, I wouldn't say journeyman, but he's traveled around, and you're 29, and this is your money contract, you're probably not rushing into it.
Yeah, DeCord's an interesting comparison because he's 28 right now and will begin the first year of a five-year extension at $5 million per season next year. That's a little rich for my blood, to be perfectly honest, for Kevin Lankinen. And, you know, I guess it depends on Demko's health and how you feel about the crease going forward. And I know the salary cap's going to go up, and a lot of things could change with the construction of this roster going forward. But, you know, you do wonder if Kevin Lankinen is playing himself into a situation where the Canucks may choose to move on from him, just because that number, like if we're talking 3.5, maybe even 4, you could convince me on shorter term, but 5 over 5, $25 million for a guy that, as much as I've liked his season, this is the first real, you know, starter caliber season he's put together in the NHL, shall we say. I don't know if I want to pay that much over that length of time for a guy that, you know, as much as I've liked him, is an older goaltender now, going to be into his 30s soon, and doesn't have a long and proven track record.
Yeah, and all it takes is one team to make that contract offer. So it doesn't necessarily have to be for the Canucks. I think you're right when he's talking about being too rich for their blood. But, you know, the Joey DeCord example is a player that's younger but has a, you know, a smaller sample size too. So Seattle, in a lot of ways, by giving that contract to Joey DeCord, has kind of set the market where if you're Kevin Lankinen and you're saying, hey, I am a year older, but I do have a larger sample size. My stats compare 909 save percentage to 905 over, you know, 50 more games. So I think the case is there, and coupled with the cap going up a little bit, you know, is there one or two teams that are willing to say, hey, he could be our 1A? He might not be a surefire, legit, you know, high-end guy, but can he be your guy for the next couple years? And that's all you need. You need one or two teams that are looking at their goaltending situation and say, we need another option, or we need to change things up. So I'm with you. I think for the Canucks, I don't think they can give that contract, but we're talking about a 32-team league here. All it takes is one team to change that.
Moving out from the crease and looking at the blue line, Brian writes in and asks, when Hronek returns, what pairings are we hoping to see? Go top heavy like last season with Hughes and Hronek, or will they try separating them? Myers with Hughes has been okay. And, you know, there's two facets to this question, I think. The first is assuming that the construction of the blue line remains the same, so that, you know, below Hughes and Hronek, it's the same personnel. I do wonder if they experiment with playing them apart, but ultimately, we've seen how effective they are together that I think Rick Tocchet and his coaching staff will probably go back to that. The interesting question for me will be, do they bring in a defenseman? Can they get a right shot defenseman onto this roster before the trade deadline? If that happens, or even if they bring in another puck mover that plays primarily on the left side, then do you experiment with playing that guy with Hronek and having Hughes with Myers and trying to sort of spread out the love a little bit and have a legitimate top four that you feel good about both pairings going out against any line that the other team's going to throw at you. But, you know, assuming the construction remains the same, I think Tocchet and his staff and Adam Foote will probably lean towards keeping Hughes and Hronek together for the most part.
Yeah, the way we probably look at it is, you know, Hughes, Hronek, Susie Myers, and forward Juleson at this point in time. We can rotate in Desharnais depending on who's playing better. But, Batch, I think the clear need for me, I think everybody sees it, is the right shot D. Could you add another lefty and maybe move one of your lefties to the right like we saw Carson Soucy playing on the right-hand side? We saw last year, you know, Ian Cole playing that. We know Rick Tocchet is not a huge fan of that, but based on scarcity, left shot D are more abundant than right shot D. So you start looking across the league, you know, there's one David Savard. There's, you know, not many right shot defensemen that you can have. And, when you talk about puck moving D, that's not necessarily the profile of a David Savard anyways. So how many guys are out there that can actually play that role? How many guys are out there potentially on the left-hand side that can move over to the right? And I'm looking at like maybe an Ivan Provorov, but he's not going to come cheap either. So internally, I think you're going to have to rotate between Juleson and Desharnais, but an upgrade either to the left or the right is very much needed. You just need some versatile lefties then in that case that can play the right side at a pretty high level in case of injury.
And one defenseman who looks like he's not going to be in the mix, at least in the short term, is Erik Brännström, who just before we started recording was placed on waivers by the Canucks for the purpose of assignment to Abbotsford. And we already had some questions in about Brännström, so this is a good opportunity to talk about him. Lionel Hutz wrote in and asked, why is Brännström not playing? He should be playing instead of Juleson, in my opinion. And Zhao writing in at the last minute here, just before we started recording, saying, why is Brännström on waivers? Tocchet needs to stop being so stubborn. So, first of all, I think this is clear that this may be an organizational opinion on Brännström rather than just the head coach, because Rick Tocchet doesn't decide who goes down to Abbotsford and who stays up. Although I'm sure he'll be a part of those conversations, but ultimately that's management that makes those sort of roster decisions. So, I guess we'll see. This might mean that Dakota Joshua is going to be activated here and is getting back to being closer to full health. That would be good news for this Canucks hockey club. Hey, I mean, it could mean Hronek is getting really close too. I guess we'll have to wait and see exactly what transpires coming out of this decision. But it is notable that it's Brännström being placed on waivers and going down, and Guillaume Brisebois, at least for the time being, as we record here now, late Sunday morning, it's Brisebois staying on the roster for the Canucks. So we'll get into some of the stuff with Brännström's play here. What are your thoughts on where things have gone wrong for him, why he might have lost the trust of the coaching staff or the organization as a whole, and why ultimately it looks like he's headed back to Abbotsford, assuming he's not claimed by another NHL team?
Yeah, this is not surprising to me based on usage, right? Like, you look at the last number of games or lack thereof usage with Erik Brännström. His path to the lineup was, when Quinn Hughes was out of the lineup, can you make a difference? Can you be the puck-moving defenseman the Vancouver Canucks need? And during that stretch, Batch, he wasn't able to make an impact, right? And offensively, whether it's power play one, we just didn't see that when he was in the lineup. Now, when Quinn Hughes came back, the way that this team wants to, and this coach wants to construct their back end is, you still have to be a very difficult team to play against in the defensive zone. They want to stick to their structure, which requires winning wall battles, breaking the cycle, and boxing out. None of those things I just mentioned there are strong suits of Erik Brännström's game. On the offensive side, we know what he can do. He's done it in the NHL, and we've seen, you know, his shot on the offensive side. But the identity of this team is still defense. The stretch of games, even though they've lost the last few here, and they beat Toronto, but especially that Toronto game, what's the identity of this team? It's, hey, you get timely scoring in that game, but you do not allow anything in the middle of the ice. You're winning the majority of your puck battles, 66% against Toronto to be specific. And Erik Brännström, just his style of play, does not match with the Redwoods that the Vancouver Canucks want back there, right? even though Ian Cole was a smaller defenseman, he played a very, you know, structured game. He played a very hard-nosed game. And, you know, small is 6 foot, 6 foot one for him. So I look at, you know, the defensemen that Vancouver currently has. Are they high-end? Not necessarily, unless your name is Quinn Hughes and Philip Hronek. But they still meet that physical need that is, hey, they're tough to play against. They're good at boxing out. They're breaking the cycle. Are they going to be the finished product? No, you want to add a better puck mover or two to this mix. But Erik Brännström just doesn't have that balance that Vancouver is looking for. Somebody who can move the puck up the ice, but also be solid defensively.
And I think Brännström is almost like a defensive version of Nils Höglander. And we'll come to talk about Höglander in a minute because we've got a question about him. But like the highs and the highlights and the things that fans notice and see on the highlight reel, see on Sportsnet Central, whatever it might be, look really good. Like Brännström's made some really good offensive plays. He did well when he had to run the power play at times. You know, there's been a lot to like from his offensive game. But there are also the lowlights, like him getting beat pretty cleanly on the outside to the front of the net at least a few times. And you're right. You talk about the ability to break up a cycle, the ability to be hard to play against in front of his own net, the ability to protect the guts of the ice, as Rick Tocchet would say. And, you know, you compare the profile of what they're looking for in a depth defenseman, you know, specifically the listener brought up Juulsen, Lionel Hutz brought up Juulsen as opposed to Brännström. Well, a couple things. Juulsen's a right shot. Brännström's a left shot. This coaching staff, generally speaking, with a few exceptions, and we saw one of those exceptions, as you alluded to, on Saturday when Carson Soucy moved to the right side. But for the most part, they want left shot guys on their strong side, right shot guys on their strong side, and especially with a defenseman that they don't completely trust on the defensive side of the puck. I don't see them giving him an opportunity on the right side. And, you know, just think about the kind of players that Rick Tocchet and Adam Foote were. Hard-nosed, tough to play against, physical, grinding type players. That's the identity that they want this team to have. And we always talk about teams taking on the identity of their coaches. That's why players like Andre Kuzmenko, Daniel Sprong, Nils Höglander to a certain extent, and Erik Brännström haven't worked within this coaching staff and within this team, because the way they want to play requires those guys to meet a baseline in terms of defensive responsibility and winning battles and protecting pucks and making strong plays along the walls. And that, to me, is where Erik Brännström falls short, even if a lot of the offensive upside looks really good.
And a part of that question also references Guillaume Brisebois. And, you know, to your point, one of the non-negotiables of Rick Tocchet hockey is, you know, you have to keep to your structure. You have to make sure that you're limiting on the defensive side of the ice, that the opposition is not getting opportunities, that, you know, you have to play that hard game in the corners, along the walls, in front of the net. And Guillaume Brisebois, even though he might be limited in his puck-moving skills or offense, he still gives you a baseline of defense that is required for Rick Tocchet hockey. And I know there's a lot of thoughts on that. Brännström's a high-risk, high-reward type of player, but that's not the way Rick Tocchet likes hockey to be played. He likes to be risk-averse when it comes to defensive hockey. He wants to be somebody that limits risk in the defensive zone. And Erik Brännström, even though I think in moments when Quinn Hughes wasn't in the lineup or they needed a bit of a change, he was able to get pucks through, you know, basically on the offensive side of things. He was able to score some goals. He was able to attack down the left-hand side along the wall. But for the defensive deficiencies, it still wasn't enough for the amount that he was giving up in his own zone. And, you know, Rick Tocchet hockey is limiting the damage and then scoring. It's not, you know, run-and-gun hockey. So in that situation, Guillaume Brisebois and that profile of player is going to get the advantage with this coach.
And I think a lot of the fan base is sort of defense of Brännström or frustration at him not playing is less a reflection of Brännström individually and more a reflection of this team's need for a puck mover. Right now, Brännström can move the puck, certainly. But let's remember, you know, this is a player that was cast off by the Ottawa Senators organization, then was cast off by the Colorado Avalanche as a throw-in in a cap dump trade when the Canucks moved off the Pullman contract, and Vancouver immediately sent him to Abbotsford. So this was not a guy that they immediately saw as being part of their plans, and I think probably a lot of the defensive issues are what led to that. But this team does need a puck mover. They just need a more reliable one than a guy that, you know, has a hard time getting into NHL lineups right now. And, you know, I guess we'll see if another team claims him, but this would be the second time that he would have cleared waivers and made it down to Abbotsford if that is indeed what happens. So I get it where you're like, that guy can move the puck. We need a guy that can move the puck, especially during that stretch when Hughes was out of the lineup. I just don't know if Brännström is the answer to that puck moving conundrum, but it is still something that management needs to address, especially if they don't feel like they have that guy internally in Erik Brännström.
Well, let me ask you this question, Batch. I think when we look at offensive capability in the NHL, and I know, you know, Brännström has put points together a little bit in his career, especially in Ottawa. But when you talk about trust, when you talk about defensive capability and the ability to move the puck, is there a huge difference between a Christian Willanen and an Erik Brännström at the NHL level?
Probably not. In fact, Christian Willanen is a larger defenseman who I might trust more to be like a tree that can break up cycles while also having the ability to move the puck up the ice like you've alluded to already.
And that was an area of focus that Rick Tocchet did want him to be a little bit more, you know, I think a little bit more of a physical presence. And he's 6'2", more on the lanky side. But going back to profile of a guy that can move the puck at the AHL level, he's, what, 12 points in 19 games this year. Going back 2 years ago, he had 55 and 49. So we know at the AHL level he can do it. The NHL level hasn't translated. But if you're talking about a 7th D or occasionally a 6th defenseman to give you something different, to give you that puck-moving ability, I don't see a huge difference between Christian Willanen and Erik Brännström at the NHL level. And, you know, I think you need Willanen to take a step to be A, healthy. He hasn't been able to be that consistently. And B, also just a little bit nastier at the NHL level. And if he can be that, I think he fits the profile a little bit more of what this coaching staff wants. To your point, a little bit bigger, and he's got the puck-moving ability, but we haven't seen it translate to the NHL level. And to be fair, also, we haven't seen that consistently from Brännström either. So to me, I think they're very similar players in that regard.
And ultimately, this is a long-winded way of saying they need a more impactful puck-moving defenseman than a guy that we're talking about as a 6'7 at best, whether that's Brännström or Willanen. And I imagine that's something that the organization will look to address going forward before the trade deadline. I mentioned Nils Höglander. Our next question comes from Jay and is about him. He asks, what is Tocchet's vision for Höglander in this lineup? After benching Höglander for a lack of production, poor defending, and ozone penalties, he then plays on the second line on the wing of the team's shutdown center. I'm confused. And I think, you know, one factor that plays into is they were playing back-to-back, so you make a couple of changes, you get some fresh legs in the lineup. That's also why Brisebois went in against the Leafs, I think, and why they were willing to move Soucy to the right side and experiment with that. But I think, you know, the highs and lows of where Höglander can be in the lineup speak to the highs and lows of Hoaglander's game, where, you know, there is the potential for a high-end offensive player there because the guy scored 24 even strength goals last year. At the same time, you know that putting him in the lineup at times is a risk because of the ozone penalties, because of the defensive miscues, because of some of the issues with hockey IQ. But for a team that, you know, especially coming into the Toronto game, a lot of the narratives were struggling about offense, and I think a lot of that is still justified, and we're going to talk about that in a moment with another question as well. Like, Höglander is still a guy that can give you offense, that can score if he gets opportunities. It's just the trade-off of what you could get by bringing him into the lineup versus how it might hurt your team because of some of the issues in his game. And that's why Hoglander hasn't been able to consistently play up the lineup or consistently be in the lineup in his NHL career to this point.
Yeah, I don't think anybody's doubting the high-end ability. I know not scoring in 30-plus games, and what, 33 games, is something that you... Obviously, he's not a confident player right now. But Batch, the bigger issue to me is what you talked about. You know, the penalties that are being taken, the on-ice decisions where, you know, he's jumping the gun on a 2-on-1 attack and it's causing an offside with him and Max Sasson. It's, you know, not having maybe that awareness of where you're on the ice and being in the way of when your teammates, as they're trying to enter the zone, that kills the offensive attack and actually launches a transition attack the other way. Those are the things that are going to frustrate coaches a little bit more to say, hey, you're not in your spot. You're not having that awareness. So sometimes you just need to take a step back. You need to watch the game from up above, and it'll teach you what maybe you've been lacking the last few games. Maybe and we hear coaches say that all the time, that sometimes a young player, even a mid-career player, needs to take a step back and watch the game from a distance. We've even heard, you know, injured players and star-level players say sometimes you just... Watching the game from above, it kind of slows it down for you. So I had no problem with the scratch. I thought his game against, you know, Washington was one that you look back and say you could have done a much better job, and that's one he wasn't confident in. But against Toronto, you know, brought some energy, played 12-plus minutes, got an opportunity to play with JT Miller, and you needed offensive chops, you needed energy, and you're hoping the player is motivated coming back into the lineup. And I think with Nils Höglander, this is going to be, until he can find consistency in the bottom six or the top six for that matter, you do have to, you know, with any young player, whether it's a Max Sasson, whether it's a Jonathan Lekkerimäki, if they're not feeling it, I have no problem with any coach saying, hey, you should probably have a look at what's going on from the press box every now and then, because let's be honest, Höglander hasn't had his A game this year compared to last year. And with Rick Tocchet, he's trying to find solutions in this lineup. And if you're not pulling the right way, or if you're making errors, there's only so many things a coach can do. And one of those things is scratch or ice time decreased. And with Höglander, he's had to use both of them.
And I'll be interested to see if Höglander stays up the lineup heading into the game against Winnipeg on Tuesday, because Jonathan Lekkerimäki was played in a fourth line role against the Leafs, but Rick Tocchet went out of his way to praise Lekkerimäki for the way he played being put in that spot in the game against the Maple Leafs. So, you know, I think with some of the offensive struggles of this team, it made sense to shake things up in the top six. And one notable change we saw was Hughes being deployed more often with the Pettersson line as opposed to the Miller line. So, you know, the conversation there from Jay about, you know, Miller being the shutdown center, I think maybe this coaching staff is moving away from that because of some of the struggles that Miller has had in his game. But, you know, that's going to be the conversation around Nils Höglander as long as he's a Canuck, or until he finds a way to find consistency in his game, is what do you have here? Do you have the 24-goal guy from last year who can, you know, be an offensive contributor and be someone that can make a difference for you? Or do you have the guy that's going to take an undisciplined penalty at a bad time in the game or lose coverage in his own zone and cost you a key goal? It's a high-risk, high-reward kind of player. And just generally speaking, from being around the game for a while, from talking to coaches, coaches don't like high risk, high reward. They want reliability. They want predictability. They want consistency. And that's why Rick Tocchet has given opportunity to guys like Phil DiGiuseppe or even Nils Åman in his time as the head coach of the Canucks over players like Nils Höglander or Andre Kuzmenko or Daniel Sprong.
Particularly based on the style of play that this team wants to play. And Batch, I think there's a lot of conversation around this year's team versus last year's team. There was talks about, you know, attacking more off the rush, opening up offensively. But fast forward this year, with the amount of injuries, this team hasn't been able to do that. Off the rush, they haven't really been a threat. So what are you now finding this team doing? They're going back into their defensive identity that was, you know, winning wall battles, keeping structure, protecting the guts of the ice, making sure that you're making high IQ plays in the defensive zone and the neutral zone. And that is very much like the style that they played last year. So, you know, if we're talking about a little bit more risk and you're attacking more off the rush, you're opening up a little bit more, maybe there's a spot for just increasing that risk a little bit more. But I don't think that's what the Canucks are doing. I think the last six games shows us that this team's identity will continue to be very good defense, limiting everything in the middle of the ice, and then picking their spots for offense, at least in the short term. And for young players, Max Sasson, for Nils Höglander, for Lekkerimäki, if you're able to play to that identity, you will get ice time. If you do not, if you're making mistakes, if you're coughing up the puck, if your awareness is off, you're not going to jive. So I feel with Höglander, the story is right in front of him. If you can play this style, if you can, you know, be trustworthy, and that's the word we've been talking about the last year for Nils Höglander. If you can gain that trust, you will be in the lineup. If you do not, you will not be in it.
All right, we got time for one more question here. It comes in from Justin in East Van, and this will be an interesting one to unpack. Justin writes in and asks, should the Canucks reconsider their approach to generating shots on net? And this has been a big conversation in the last few days, especially coming out of the Carolina game where they struggled to generate, didn't score. You juxtapose that with the Washington game and the number of shots they generated against the Capitals. And a lot of people were saying, you know, this is too permissive an offensive team. They're right near the bottom of the league in terms of shots per game this year. But Rick Tocchet has always talked about, you know, you don't want to just shoot the puck for the sake of shooting the puck. And that makes a lot of sense, because if you're just taking a low percentage shot that doesn't have a chance of creating anything, you're just giving up possession. And Rick Tocchet's team wants to have the puck, wants to possess the puck. The best way to defend is to prevent the other team from controlling the puck, because then they can't score. Now, do they need to create a little bit more? Yes, I think they do. But I don't think that's so much philosophical as it has been execution or lack thereof. I think Rick Tocchet wants his team to generate offense. He talks all the time about needing to get more pucks on the net, and he was railing against his team missing the net or passing up shooting opportunities on good looks after the game against Carolina. So I don't know if they need to all of a sudden become the Corsi Kings and generate a ton of shot volume. And in fact, I don't think that's going to happen, because that's never been the way that they've played under Rick Tocchet. But it's more on the players to say, okay, we're going to get bodies to the net, we're going to get pucks to the net, so that when we do put it on net, it's not just a throwaway, give up possession kind of play, but it's, get a puck through, get a stick on it. And we saw them have success doing just that in the game against the Maple Leafs on Saturday.
For sure we did. And the first two goals of the game were exactly that, right? What, 30 seconds in, Brock Besser gets a tip on that shot from the point. Quinn Hughes ends up scoring as well. So that low to high does work, right? If you're able to get deflections, if you're able to get rebounds, those are high percentage plays. So I don't have a problem with the strategy. Where I do have a problem, Batch, is that teams will play you a certain way. They will front you. And we've seen that in the last few games. We've seen that going back to Nashville versus Vancouver in the first round. Edmonton did that. We've seen it this year. Do you have a variety in your attack? That's where I think Vancouver, within games, especially as we get closer to March and April, I don't think they should necessarily change their approach to generating shots on net. But in games where teams are not giving you that shooting lane, if you're having a very difficult time finding that deflection, maybe you got a team like the Vegas Golden Knights of their Stanley Cup winning year that have absolute massive defensemen that plug up lanes, what is your alternate way of attack? And I feel like this team can generate down low a little bit more. They've got players that are suited to that role. So I don't think they should necessarily change the way they think about playing the game. It's more of a, all right, if teams are going to front you, if they're having success getting in front of your shots, do you have a plan B? In certain games, it doesn't seem like Vancouver has a plan B, and plan A is going straight into the equipment of the opposing forwards, and it's being, you know, blocked, or, you know, they're not finding that shot or those high danger chances. It's basically feast or famine. And that's why I think plan B is also something this team needs.
Yeah, and Rick Tocchet has talked about his defensemen needing to get more pucks through on net. So part of that, you know, as you point out, like philosophically, teams are going to front you more when they know that's the way you want to play. Part of that is personnel based, though, too, and comes back to the conversation we were having earlier about needing a puck moving type of defenseman back there. If it's Quinn Hughes on the blue line, you trust him to walk the line, change the angle, find a way to get a puck through. I don't know if my expectation is there for Noah Juulsen or Vincent Desharnais or Derek Forbert to be able to do the same thing. So, you know, certainly Quinn Hughes can do that. If you go and get another puck mover, they can do that. Tyler Myers has the ability to do that at some point. But you're right. You know, you need to find a way to create offense in those minutes where guys who don't really have that skill set are on the ice, because if you keep playing it back to Juulsen at the line and he keeps teeing off, you know, he's just not going to be a guy that dances the line and makes a play to create a shooting lane like Quinn Hughes does. That's just not in his makeup. It's not in his skill set. It's not the kind of defenseman he is. And really, it's not the reason they have him in the lineup either, as we've talked about. It's the physical defending side of his game that they like. So, you know, in those minutes where Quinn Hughes isn't on the ice, which is more than half the game, with the personnel they have right now, you're right. They need to find a way to generate more. And I think in the past, they've done a really good job of creating down low in the zone and making plays from behind the net to forwards in soft areas in the slot. You know, I'd like to see some more of that from this team rather than, you know, just back to the point every time you don't have anything in the middle of the ice. Rick Tocchet always talks to holding on to pucks and making plays. I think when this team isn't confident, it looks sort of formulaic and stale because they're not seeing plays. And instead of holding on to a puck and waiting for something to open up, you go, well, there's nothing there. I'll just play it back to the point because that's what we're supposed to do. So if this team can gain some confidence, gain some traction, get on a good run, have some good results, I think we'll see some more of that offensive creativity come to the forefront. But for the moment, with some of the guys they've got in the lineup, I understand that this is a way they feel they need to play to have success. And ultimately, on some nights, it's going to work if you can be opportunistic and get those pucks and bodies to the net like they did against the Leafs on Saturday. But there are going to be nights where it's going to be hard for you to generate. And that's where the conversation comes back to the Canucks' top players needing to make a big difference.
Well, Batch, I don't want to pick on Noah Juulsen here, but there is a stat from Clearsight Analytics that references he's got the lowest quality shot or shooting chances in the NHL amongst all players that there is data for. So, you know, those shots that are coming in from the point, that's not his game, to your point. But, you know, is it worthwhile having a defenseman taking that shot, going low to high? And if that's the player that's taking it, like, he's got some power behind some of those shots. We see the 91 miles per hour, 88. But if it's not a high-quality chance, or if it's going straight into the opposing players, right into their shins, it's not something you're generating. Now, one area I think Vancouver could do a better job, and we've seen it historically, is down low, JT Miller can make those passes, whether it's a backhand feed to the slot to find Brock Besser. Connor Garland's been able to make those. We've seen Dakota Joshua last year make those plays as well. You know, I think with Jake DeBrusk, this would be an even more dangerous team, potentially playing with Elias Pettersson. So, yeah, I think, you know, I like the way that they play. Don't get me wrong. I think going low to high certainly has advantages, but you know, you do need some variety in your attack. And that's something I hope this team develops over the next few games.
All right. That does it for this week's edition of In the Booth. As always, Randy, thank you for joining me on the show this week. It's the Canucks and the Winnipeg Jets coming up on Tuesday. We'll have it for you right here on Sportsnet 650. It is a 5 o'clock faceoff from Manitoba. Pre-game show at 4 on Tuesday on your official home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650.